Well, comrades and friends, one of the themes of socialism this weekend is going to be the different mass movements and revolutions which this year we've been commemorating. And obviously with the developments in Iran this year around the so-called election, something which will be discussed in more detail tomorrow, the question of what happened 30 years ago in Iran has come back, if you like, onto the agenda in a way of saying, was it inevitable that the present regime came out of that movement which overthrew the Shah's regime 30 years ago? And in one sense, both when we're discussing Iran and when tomorrow there's going to be a discussion on what happened in East Germany in 20 years ago, in both cases we're looking at developments of movements which took place in a peculiar way, in the sense that in Iran we had a revolution against a dictatorial regime which then seemed to bring to power this Islamic Republic, a religious-based regime, and in a way was seen as something which was opened the door to the increased role of religion which we have seen in the subsequent years. And certainly when we're discussing something like Iran 30 years ago, it is not meant to be a history lesson. It's not a question of describing, as one may do at school or elsewhere, what happened at different times, but looking at the developments, seeing what can be learned from it, what lessons can be learned from it, from the point of view of struggles which will unfold in the future. Now, obviously, history doesn't repeat itself. Doesn't repeat itself exactly. But there are questions which come out of the Iranian revolution which are still applicable today. On the one hand, how revolutions actually develop. Secondly, the question of the roles I've just briefly mentioned of religious ideas in mass movements. What happens when religious ideas get a mass following, become a real factor in political and the social life? Something which isn't just seen in, if you like, in some of the Islamic countries, but also we've seen it with the growth of Christian fundamentalism in different countries, whether it be in Africa, in Asia, or even if you look at the United States today. A key factor on the political scene in the United States today is the religious right, the Christian fundamentalists. They are an important factor in the United States political situation. And so, therefore, the questions both of mass movements and the role of religion and how socialists relate to the role of religion and what lessons can be learned from the revolution in Iran and elsewhere are really a subject matter of what we're discussing this afternoon. Because obviously, if we're as activists, we argue against capitalism, we argue for a program which can immediately defend and improve the living conditions of the working class, youth, and even sections of the middle classes as well. But at the same time, while we conduct these day-to-day activities, while we're involved in the individual struggles which can take place, like the recently suspended post-strike here in Britain, at the same time, we're always waiting for, not in a passive sense, but in one sense, we are waiting for the time of mass movements, of revolutions, when millions upon millions of people actually move into action, when it's possible to get a wider response for our ideas. It may seem far off when we're living like we are at the present time in Britain, in a relatively quiet period, when there are things happening, when a lot of people are extremely angry, fearful of what's happening in the future. But at the present time, we do not see mass movements, and therefore it can seem a bit abstract that we're discussing it, but nevertheless, it's important to discuss how mass movements unfold, how revolutions unfold, so that we can have an idea of what to do, how to be politically active, how to struggle for socialist ideas when these movements come again. Now, as I said before, history doesn't repeat itself. And certainly, each revolution is individual. I've had the fortunate experience to participate in four revolutions and at least two counter-revolutions in my political activity. And when I went to Iran over 30 years ago, when I got on the ground, it wasn't exactly what I expected. And that's perhaps inevitable, because you have a general idea. But then when you actually go to a country, when you actually go to a situation, then you see what is actually going on the ground, the peculiarities, the specific situation which actually develops. But nevertheless, through a general understanding of how revolutions develop, of how you have movements within revolutions, of how revolution and counter-revolution develop, through that general understanding, you can then, if you like, learn more about what is actually happening in the particular situation you're in, and most importantly, draw conclusions from it. Now, it's important to look at the history of the movement in Iran, because at the present time, there is, and we've seen it for a whole series of years now in the West, this, if you like, demonization of of not just the Iranian regime, but also of Iran itself. It's like it's presented that the outcome of the Islamic Republic, of the Khomeini regime, was the absolutely inevitable outcome of the overthrow of the Shah. That the revolution inevitably was going to end up in the Islamic regime. And there's also an attempt, if you like, to whitewash the old monarchy, the old regime of the Shah. Now, we have to be very aware of this when we're discussing Iran. It doesn't mean that we become uncritical supporters of Iran. We see that with Chavez, where Chavez is the president of Venezuela. His position is, and he will support anyone who comes into conflict with U.S. imperialism. So therefore, because U.S. imperialism criticized for its own reasons the vote rigging in Iran, Chavez immediately supported the present Iranian regime, supported the so-called farce of the elections, etc., etc. We don't have that position. We understand that in analyzing from a socialist point of view what is happening in Iran, we have to be independent of imperialism, at the same time as being independent, obviously, of the Iranian regime. Now, as I said, there's an attempt, if you like, to whitewash the old regime in Iran, the Shah's regime, which was overthrown. A regime which was installed by a coup in 1953, led by British and US imperialism. A regime which was based on the dictatorship. On average, there were 50,000 political prisoners being held in Iran at the time. Suppression of all sorts of opposition movements. No legal space for political parties, for trade unions, and the suppression of national minorities. This was, if you like, a dictatorial regime, but nevertheless a dictatorial regime which had the idea it wanted to try and modernize the country. And in trying to modernize the country in the 1960s, it came into conflict with one of its previous allies. And that ally was Khomeini, the religious leadership. The religious leadership supported the coup in 1953, which brought the Shah back to power, which ousted a sort of moderate nationalist regime under Mossadegh, which had nationalized the oil industries. This coup, backed by US and British imperialism in 53, was also backed by the religious leadership around Khomeini. They also backed that coup. But when the Shah, about 10 years later, attempted a program of modernization, which included what he called a land reform, which partly meant taking away from the religious institutions the land which they owned, they then came into conflict with the Shah. The religious leadership also opposed some of the limited measures which the Shah had proposed to improve the positions of women. And this led it, and this was the break in the early 1960s, which led to the ultimate opposition of the religious hierarchy, the majority of the religious leadership against the Shah's regime. Now, what we saw in the 1960s and the 1970s was a general development of opposition to the Shah's regime. We saw, especially in the 1970s, the beginning of a development of the workers' movement in Iran, And also, it was clear that the Shah's regime was weakening. And the question was, how would a movement actually develop? The conditions were, if you like, ripening. The question was, what would be the actual spark which would provoke the movement? And in a way, the spark was if you like, ignited, so to speak, in 1977, with clashes between supporters of Khomeini, between religious elements, and the Shah's forces. That gave rise to a series of regular demonstrations which started to develop through 1977 and then in into 1978. And then in the autumn of 78, we saw a qualitative change in that development, with these protests which had been significant but relatively isolated suddenly broadening out. And suddenly we saw, in the second half of 1978, an enormous development of a mass movement which became a revolution which ultimately overthrew the Shah's regime. Because rapidly this movement of opposition developed momentum in all the major cities in Iran. The increasing attempts of the Shah's regime to forcibly suppress this movement only provoked more response. Thus we saw the development of mass strikes beginning to take place from October 1978 onwards in Iran. We saw mass demonstrations. At that time, the Iranian population was about 33 million. In December of 1978, there was a demonstration of over 2 million in Tehran in opposition against the Shah's regime. And this protest was shaking the entire basis of Iranian society. And we saw, in a way, a semi-insurrectional mood developing in Iran at that time. The Iranian movement was one of the first movements which, to a certain extent, was being televised. We didn't have in that stage things like CNN and, you know, the 24-hour news bulletins. But, if you like, there was more media and there's more TV and film footage of the movement coming out than there'd been in previous revolutions. It was one of the first revolutions to be televised, so to speak, to make an old joke. Because in this case it was televised. And what you saw, what was very interesting, what you saw, was not just the size of the demonstrations, not just the fighting, but also increasingly you saw soldiers and police switching sides. There was actually sometimes film of soldiers running, you know, breaking ranks away from the military and joining the protesters, or soldiers handing over their weapons to the protesters in the street. This was captured, if you like, in the TV, which towards the end of 1978, the beginning of 1979. And in this situation, it was absolutely clear that the Shah's regime was doomed. In the end, he left the country at the beginning of 1979, and we, at the same time, we had the return of Khomeini from exile. He'd been living in France for a number of years, and that, if you like, symbolized the downfall of the old regime and the beginning, if you like, of the new period of the revolution. Now, it was absolutely clear by this time that, if you like, religious ideas were playing a key role in the movement which was developing in Iran. That was absolutely clear. There were a number of reasons for this, which I'll go into shortly. But it was absolutely clear that the revolution was taking place under the banner of the idea of an Islamic republic. Now, this, in one sense, wasn't unusual. We've seen in other movements in other countries sometimes, movements beginning partly under religious banners or even under religious leaders. A notable example is the 1905 revolution in Russia, which actually began, although on the question of wages, it was a movement which was led by a Christian priest. They very quickly got pushed to one side, but it was just an illustration of the role which religion, both religious ideas and religious leaders, can play in different times. But what, of course, was different in Iran was the fact that the religious ideas weren't just something which was a temporary phenomenon, wasn't something which just was a passing phase, because it's dominated the whole history of Iran from that period. But also we have to understand that the religious ideas under which the revolution was carried out did not mean the same to everyone at that particular time. What was really noticeable during my time in Iran at that period was that from the point of view of most of the youth workers and soldiers that I was able to come in contact with, what they meant by Islamic Republic was a republic of the people, a republic of the poor. That's actually what they meant. It was, and they meant a republic which was democratic, against the Shah's dictatorship. They meant, by saying a government of the people, of the poor, it was a rejection, if you like, of the Shah's capitalist road of development. The fact that, obviously, in such a situation, the elite were immensely wealthy, and the mass were not. And this was the, if you like, the driving idea of the mass of the population. Khomeini himself had a completely different idea. He had a completely different, absolutely reactionary idea of establishing some kind of reactionary authoritarian rule in reality. And thus, from the very beginning of the period after the overthrow of the Shah, there was this dichotomy, there was this tension between what the mass of the people meant by the Islamic Republic, and what the Khomeini and the religious leaders around him actually meant. And this meant that Khomeini himself, had to tread very carefully. Initially, he tried to introduce different reactionary measures and was forced back. So, to give an example, very early on, in March 1979, they launched a campaign against naked women. And what they meant by that was that any woman who was unveiled was regarded as being naked. There started to be attacks on women who weren't veiled. This provoked an enormous backlash, an enormous protest movement. And Khomeini himself had to retreat, had to say that they didn't... That it didn't have to be implemented immediately. He partially retreated, and only later did they actually enforce that. It was, if you like, an early example, if you like, of the conflicting views in Iran at that particular time. Also, there were different forces in Iran. As I said earlier, the Shah's regime had come, if you like, had been restored in 1953 on the basis of the overthrow of the sort of, soft nationalist Mossadegh government, a government which had nationalised the oil industry. And Mossadegh was seen as, like, both as a national hero in Iran, but also as a non-religious figure. And when shortly after the revolution in 1979, There was the 12th anniversary of Mossadegh's death. Over 1 million people participated in a demonstration in Tehran to mark the anniversary of Mossadegh's death, which was also seen as a rally against, if you like, the religious leadership, a rally which was in favour of a more secular Iran. And this, if you like, indicated the tensions which were going on. So from the beginning, the religious leaders around Khomeini had to be quite careful. They had a balancing act. First of all, obviously, as in that situation, everything had the name revolutionary added to it to make it sound like it was something was actually happening. At the same time, they were quite skillful in deception. I mentioned earlier how the population was being armed during the revolution itself. Very quickly upon coming into power, Khomeini issued a decree saying it was un-Islamic for anybody to have their own gun. And there was a certain reaction against that. And then they said, okay, you hand your guns in, and we'll keep the guns at local mosques, so if necessary, you can get them from the local mosques. And they had these photographs of people handing in their guns and the guns being stored in the local mosques. The only thing that they were also doing, they were taking the firing mechanisms out of the weapons, You couldn't see that immediately from the photograph. But taking the firing weapons out, so if you like, the illusion was given to people. Yes, your guns are in the local mosque. If you need it, you can always go and get it. But in fact, it would have been useless because they had no firing mechanism anymore. They could have used them to hit somebody, but not fire them. And it was an example, if you like, of this sort of balancing, which was actually taking place. Now, in this situation, I think it is quite accurate to say that the ultimate victory of Khomeini's counter-revolution was not ineligible at that stage. It was still a question of how the revolution would unfold, what forces would actually develop. Now, the reasons for Khomeini's victory, in one sense, lie in some of the objective developments which took place, and also, unfortunately, the lost opportunities which the left in Iran at that stage weren't able to seize. Now, from the point of view of the general development of the situation, what was absolutely key in Iran was the outbreak of the eight-year war in 1980 between Iran and Iraq. Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran was an essential factor in allowing Khomeini to consolidate his regime at that time. Under the banner of defending the revolution against the external attack, and we should remember that in Iran, this war was seen as an imperialist war because Saddam Hussein was backed by Western imperialism. It's forgotten now after the wars in Iraq and everything that happened, but at that stage he was backed by Western imperialism. And it's the reason why the Iranian population fought against the invasion. Now, one third of the Iranian population is actually Arab. And Saddam, not Persian in that sense. And Saddam Hussein thought that the Arab minority would support his invasion, but they didn't. They fought against it because it was seen it wasn't seen simply in national terms. It was seen as an attack on the revolution by imperialism. And Khomeini was able to utilize an anti-imperialist mood and also a patriotic mood in order to consolidate his regime. And it's the reason why very rapidly in the early part of the war, it was the period when Khomeini himself was able to consolidate the counter-revolution and suppress all the other independent movements which had developed. But in the period between the overthrow of the Shah and the outbreak of the war in 1980, there was an opportunity, there was a window of opportunity to build an independent workers' movement which could have changed the whole situation in Iran. Because what happened in Iran in 1979 was not simply just the overthrow of one regime, its replacement by another. It was a true mass movement. And I'll just give a few quotations to things which actually I picked up when I was in Iran itself, that within 2 weeks of the new government, of the Khomeini-backed government coming into power, one of the leaders of the government was complaining that, quote, "None of the country's factories are functioning at the present time because workers are holding continual political meetings. The back-to-work orders issued by Ayatollah Khomeini and the government are not being obeyed by left-wing workers who are demanding the right to elect their own managers and refuse to accept government-appointed managers." Now, this was just, if you like, one indication of the ferment which was developing in the workplaces. Not just the continual meetings, but in the workplaces. Committees had been elected by the workers. New trade unions had been developed. And it wasn't just a question of fighting, if you like, on immediate trade union issues, but what was also clear was an attempt of sections of workers to raise the question of who's running the industries, of who is controlling what is going on, of the demands for nationalisation, of workers' control of the different industries were coming up. And in one sense, we could say, in some of the workplaces at least, the workers in Iran at that stage had a certain strength. They felt their own strength. They felt that they'd undermined and then overthrown the Shah's dictatorship. They'd beaten one of the most repressive regimes in the world. I mean, in the 1970s, the Shah's regime had been infamous for the efficiency of the SAVAK, its secret police force. And so workers had a certain confidence that they'd beaten that repressive apparatus and were now seeking to use this new power which they felt to change their conditions. And the government itself in Iran was struggling to try and actually control the situation. And it became very clear, very immediately, that the Iranian regime was terrified of elections, was terrified of anything which would give, if you like, a further scope to the working class to organize itself. And this was seen, for instance, in regard to the call for a constituent assembly. Now, one of the demands in the revolution in Iran had been for a constituent assembly, in other words, a democratically elected body, which would write a new constitution for Iran. And on the it became absolutely clear that the new government, the Khomeini-led government, was terrified of such elections. On the 7th, if you just give a few ideas of what was happening, on the 17th of February, the government announced they would hold elections to a new constituent assembly soon to allow people to vote. Then a few days later, on February the 24th, they announced that before the elections to the constituent assembly were held, they would hold a referendum so people could say yes or no whether they wanted an Islamic Republic. And only afterwards would they have the elections to the constituent assembly. 5 days after that, they then announced there would be no elections to the constituent assembly, that people would be asked to vote yes or no to a constitution for an Islamic Republic. And then 2 days after that, it was announced that Ayatollah Khomeini had already agreed the constitution for the Islamic Republic. Now, maybe I've gone through those dates too quickly. It doesn't matter. It's sort of history lesson, as I said. But the point is that it showed how increasingly they were terrified of giving any voice to giving any opportunity to the working class in Iran to actually express themselves, to vote, to organize the political parties, participate in elections in this way, and give themselves their own voice. And thus, from the beginning, Ayatollah Khomeini was desperately attempting to control this situation. But nevertheless, despite that, Khomeini couldn't immediately go towards repression. They had to balance their policies. Therefore, faced with this enormous ferment in the factories, in the summer of 1979, there was a wave of nationalizations in Iran. The nationalization of the banks and of industries. And still to this day, the major banks in Iran are nationalized. 60% of Iranian industry is still nationalized to this day. Obviously, Iran, given the character of its economy, is largely dependent on oil and gas. And so manufacturing, it's a bit like Britain, has a very small amount, but nevertheless, the majority of that is nationalized, as is the oil and gas industry still nationalized. And the fact that the government now in Iran is only very cautiously going towards privatization is partly a reflection still of the fact that the nationalizations were immensely popular and seen as part of the struggle against the Shah's regime and the old elite. So, in this situation, we had the Khomeini government balancing, forced sometimes to take different measures to meet the demands of the masses, at the same time seeking to prevent any independent political development by the working class. Now, in this situation, the question was, what should the left have actually done? How should the left have actually reacted? What steps would have been necessary to build an independent workers' movement in Iran, which could have changed the situation in that particular country? Now, I think if you look at the left in Iran at that period, it was divided into a number of different groupings and tendencies. But, if you like, one thing which was common between all the different major groupings, I'm not talking about small groups, but the major groupings in Iran at that first stage, is that they all had the idea that the next thing to fight for in Iran would be a democratic capitalist system. That was their general idea. Winning of democratic demands, fighting to have a democratic capitalist system which would allow a certain further development, they hoped, of the Iranian economy, which would prepare the way, if you like, for a movement against capitalism and for socialism sometime in the future. It was, if you like, the policy which the communist parties internationally had developed from the 1930s onwards. And therefore, in this situation, while many of the left groups were very brave and many of them suffered horrific repression under the Shah's regime, nevertheless, they continually looked for so-called progressive allies who they could link up with in this fight, as they saw it, to build a democratic capitalist Iran. They rejected the view, they rejected the position, which we argued for, that in the present period, in the period which we're in, you cannot just look at the developments in any one country in isolation. It's a question of looking from a world scale. And therefore, if you look at the situation in Iran then, or in other countries subsequently, you cannot just view it in isolation. You have to see that it's partly, there's in a world situation which is dominated by imperialism. And in this situation, it is very difficult to see how any individual country can actually undergo the path of development which countries like in Western Europe or the United States underwent. And if you look even in the post-Second World War period, those countries which have had a period of development, which have these formerly more backward countries, which have developed, like South Korea or like Malaysia, they developed for specific reasons, because world imperialism wanted them to develop because of geopolitical reasons in the old days of the Cold War. And that, if you like, they were given benevolent treatment, they were given concessions to be allowed to develop by the major imperialist powers. But this hasn't been normally the case for most of the countries in most of the countries of Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. And in this situation, you couldn't foresee a development of a democratic capitalist Iran over a period of time. And more importantly, because already in Iran there was in existence a working class and a potential for a working class movement, that meant that there was the potential there for the working class itself to come to power, to overthrow capitalism, and in that sense begin an international movement, in that sense appeal to an international movement against capitalism and imperialism. We were putting forward the same viewpoint which, if you like, inspired the Russian Revolution of 1917, where Lenin and Trotsky and the Bolsheviks came to power in a very backward country in 1917. They came to power with the point of view of not being able to build socialism in Russia at that particular moment, but from the point of view of being part of an international movement and hoping that their example would lead to similar movements in other countries, which would, if you like, open the way to transforming the world. But the left in Iran, not having that internationalist perspective, but having that, if you like, that idea of stages, of the next stage being a democratic capitalist republic, that opened the way to them seeking allies. And what this immediately meant in Iran in 1979 was the question of how to deal with Khomeini and the mass support which he had. Now, I spoke before about the movements which were developing from below. The movements in the factories, the resistance to the imposition of the veil, so on and so forth. But even with those movements, Khomeini at that stage had an incredible position in Iran. Had an absolutely incredible position. Because he was seen as the figurehead of the movement which had overthrown the Shah. He had a tremendous position at that stage. And obviously, if you were going to be seriously politically active, you couldn't avoid that. You couldn't avoid that question. You couldn't avoid the question of how to deal with his mass if not support, at least his popularity, his symbolism, so to speak. And unfortunately, the left groups did not know how to deal with that, and also because they had a policy, if you like, of looking towards progressive allies, they sought to co-opt themselves to add themselves onto the Khomeini movement itself. And thus we had a situation where all the major left groups gave different statements of support to the Khomeini movement. The Communist Party in Iran, which had, if you like, a fairly long history in that country, and had a certain base among sections of the working class, already before the Shah was overthrown, publicly pledged their support to Khomeini, saying they support him, they want to work with him. The other groups had the same sort of attitude as well, that they would seek to work with Khomeini. Even some of the more radical ones, while not maybe mentioning Khomeini himself, wanted to join the government. One of the biggest of the left groups, the Fedayeen, which later in 1980, they split into two, but in 79 they were one organisation. They didn't actually directly praise Khomeini, but what they asked for is they wanted to join the government which Khomeini had appointed. They asked to become ministers of the government. That was their orientation. Yes, they were often fighting for demands for workers, for women and youth. You know, individual demands which everyone would support. But their overall strategy was, if you like, the Fedayeen, was could we get a position in the government, and this way could we help to implement what they call progressive measures. Unfortunately, that was also added, the fact that some of the groups, because of the arming of the population in the course of the revolution, had the illusion in weapons. I mean, it's funny and it's also tragic. I had meetings with the leadership of the Fedayeen, and if you went to their headquarters in Tehran at that time, in, say, March, April, 79, everyone in the building was armed. I mean, it was a bit this sort of gun fetish to be, you know, everyone, you know, it's like these, you know, American cops film, they're all walking around, everyone's walking with shoulder guns and clashing the cops over, or rifles over their arms. They had one tank parked outside, two armoured personnel carriers. You know, you went into a meeting, you know, and you just hope they know how to handle the guns. You know, if you have a gun, you either meant it pointed up or pointed down. But sometimes they pointed, you know, for God's sake, you don't even know it's up or down. Not at somebody, unless you want to shoot them. You know, it's funny in a way, but it's tragic, because they had the illusion that, if you like, that weaponry which they had, their one tank, their two armoured personnel carriers, would defend them. And it didn't in the end, and most of them died very rapidly, by the way. They were killed by the regime. It's not a funny thing. But if you like, you see how a mixture of a wrong political program coupled with, which you can sometimes get this weapons fetish when there's being army, you know, led people into this horrible trap. And what this meant was that they weren't able, if you like, to build an independent movement. Now, it was difficult to deal with this. The question was, how would you actually politically advance a program to build an independent workers' movement in a situation where there was this, if you like, support for Khomeini, and also where most people were saying that they were Islamic. I mean, it was a common description, but in one sense it didn't mean the same thing among different people. To give an example here from Britain today, you have the situation where you have fundamentalist Christians. At the same time, a large number of people, or used to be, if you ask them what they are, they'd say C of E, just as a matter of course. It didn't mean the same thing. There was a difference, if you like, between people who just filled in form C of E and those who are fundamentalist Christians. And a similar situation in Iran at that particular time. But the question was, how would you actually deal with it? And in our opinion, what we argued for was, yes, they needed to have a strategy towards building an independent workers' movement. That would mean by taking up the immediate demands which the workers were raising. Raising the question of what, you know, of having a dialogue with the class under the question of what does an Islamic Republic mean for you? When you got the general answer, it meant a republic of the people, a republic of the poor. Then to say, well, how are we going to get it? How are we going to implement that? How is it going to be run? And in this way, introducing a program quite concretely, without immediately, if you like, challenging the religious leaders, but then showing through experience how the religious leaders and their policies and their attempt to institute a fundamentally reaction regime was running counter to the demands of the workers and youth, and therefore through experience undermine the political position of the religious leadership. Now, unfortunately, this wasn't done. Now, Khomeini himself carried out different, as I said before, balancing tricks. Another key factor, which I haven't mentioned, if you like, in helping Khomeini to consolidate himself, was the occupation of the American embassy, the seizure of the hostages. I think it was 444 days. That, if you like, was also an element of a diversion. You know, this whole institution of the chant, which is still to this day, "Death to America." It was, if you like, introduced as a way of as a diversion of showing that the regime was struggling against imperialism, was struggling for the people. But it was a diversion because at the same time the regime was attempting to consolidate its own control. And this really, if you like, opened the way to the tragedy of what actually happened, because as the Khomeini regime was able to consolidate itself, as the workers' movement, if you like, couldn't find a way forward, we saw, especially from 1980 onwards, the increasing repression, as I said before, helped by the war with Iraq. And so therefore, by 1982-1983, all opposition groups had been fundamentally wiped out. The left had been pushed into the underground or wiped out. And that included groups like the Communist Party and like the biggest part of the Fedayeen, which had, in the early 1980s, actually collaborated and joined the government led by Khomeini, who then were pushed out of the government in 82 and finally brutally suppressed in 83. And this wasn't simply a question of just people being removed from their positions. It was, as I said, a brutal repression. A brutal repression, as if you like, the Khomeini regime established its own form of dictatorship. A very peculiar dictatorship, because, if you like, it, in one sense, it wasn't a classic capitalist dictatorship. It was a dictatorship led by this religious elite, which based itself on increasingly powerful state apparatus, and also, to a certain extent, on its control of the economy through nationalizations. Now, in drawing my remarks to a close, the situation today in Iran is obviously quite different, and that will be discussed more in the session tomorrow. It's changed in many different ways. On the one hand, the population has enormously expanded. It's now over 70 million. As we know, the population in Iran is extremely young. It's mainly an urban population. Two-thirds of the Iranian population live now in cities. And there's also, most importantly, been the experience of the past 30 years. And that means, I think, that even if you look at the movements which have taken place this year, the question of democratic rights will actually come far more to the fore in the coming period. I think as well, though, there'll be other significant differences. In the 1970s, when the Iranian Revolution took place, the international situation was obviously different. We had the world divided, if you like, between capitalism and Stalinism. Stalinism, which wasn't socialism, but itself didn't rest on a capitalist economy. And it was seen in the 1970s that there were choices which way to go. There were choices between either capitalism or some version of socialism. That was seen as a general choice. The 1970s had been a period of revolutions in different countries, not just in Iran. And therefore, if you like, in Iran, at the end of the 1970s, there's a popular support for nationalisation, the support, if you like, for breaking with capitalism and imperialism, was quite widespread. And it was one of the reasons for this movement in the factories, which we saw at that particular time. Today, as we know, the situation is quite different. The consciousness is different. And we can have the situation in Iran, where there is a demand for democratic rights, hostility for US imperialism, but also even illusions, though, in the West, illusions in the, even in the United States. Not in the sense of the United States government, but in the sense of the United States living standards. That's something which is quite clearly exists, at least among sections of the population in Iran at the present time. So it's possible that when the new movement develops in Iran, if you like, it'll have a stronger emphasis on democratic rights at first, and if you like, less immediate or less emphasis at first on the social and economic questions, though inevitably they will kick in later. But the key lesson which comes out of the, if you like, the revolution which I've attempted to briefly outline, is the question for, if you like, for ourselves as socialists, of how do you build an independent workers' movement? The question of keeping the political independence from different pro-capitalist forces, which doesn't mean, for instance, not struggling jointly with other forces on individual issues like individual democratic rights, but not having the idea that the next stage in Iran is an attempt to build a democratic capitalist society, having a clear program which is trying to raise the idea of overthrowing capitalism, and at the same time of having the idea of how skillfully to deal with the question that the vast majority of the population are still religious. This is inevitable, I think, in Iran. In the next period, there'll be a reaction against Khomeini's rule. There'll be a reaction against religion by significant players, particularly by, I think, by young people. At the same time, you'll still have the basis of religious ideas, and there'll be a question of how do you build a workers' movement with clear program, at the same time taking account of those ideas, and not, if you like, capitulating for them. And in that sense of looking towards the future, it's worthwhile to, if you like, look at the lessons of the past. So, as I said right at the beginning, history doesn't repeat itself exactly, but nevertheless, it's important from the point of view of the fact that now we've seen this year the beginnings of new movements in Iran, which may have gone into a certain lull, but will pick up again in the future, and therefore the question of what happened in the past will become relevant again for the future.